This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Language can be used to connect people, but sometimes language rules can cause confusion, debates, even an occasional argument among family and friends. Our next guest set out to settle those disputes by hitting the road. She's traveled around the country, setting up her grammar table where she answers questions from passerbys. Or is that passersby? We're listening back to our conversation about the funky twists and turns of spelling, punctuation, grammar, and more in the English language. And you can let us know about your grammar debates by emailing ideas@wpr.org. What words or grammar rules are you not quite sure about? Is there a grammar divide in your own household? What quirks of the English language do you either enjoy or maybe find a little annoying? Email ideas@wpr.org. Ellen Jovin is co-founder of a communication skills training consultancy called Syntaxis. She's the author of the book Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. I talked to her back in August. Here's a listen. How did you get started as a roving grammarian setting up your grammar advice table?
I wasn't that roving at first. At first, I like grammar, in case that isn't clear yet. And one day I said, hey, I need a grammar table. So I ordered a table, made a sign, and I walked outside my building. There's a little park right there. So I didn't even have to go a full block. And I put it down and I started answering questions. So I roved one block initially, but then I started moving further around the city and eventually around the country.
And people, you set up shop here with your table, and people, it seems like, were really interested. They came up and had conversations and questions and arguments they had on hand. People love to talk about this with you.
They really do. And to me, it's not surprising at all. Sometimes people say, who cares about grammar? No one cares about grammar anymore. And I'm thinking, you need to sit at the table with me for an hour, because people definitely care about it. They love talking about it. They love fake fighting about it. It can be really hilarious. It's this wonderful bonding instrument for conversation.
Let's get a taste of it. You shared an example with us from a grammar table interaction, this one in Milwaukee, so we can get a flavor of what's going on here. Here's a listen.
It's the grammar table. Do you have any grammar questions?
Yes, the use of commas, spoke. Commas like to describe stuff, like more than one thing. Like,
if you have a list.
Dark brown hair, blue eyes, red lips, stuff like that.
That was very visually, I can't think of a word right now. You've left the grammar table speechless. So are you asking about the comma before the and, if it's a list of things?
No, how do we use more commas? We choose not to use commas at all, just a stream of consciousness.
Is this the collective familial we, or does we mean your kids?
My kids.
Sounds like this was a lot of fun. And I think a key, Ellen, is that you're not judgy about this at all, as far as I can tell. You wouldn't correct me and say, don't you mean judgmental, Rob?
I definitely wouldn't. I don't feel judgmental at all. I just think to me, this is really fun. And I'll just answer whatever question people have. I don't tackle them when they walk by. If I hear them use the wrong past participle, that's not how this works.
We're talking to Ellen Jovin, author of the new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. She brought her grammar table to almost every state in the country, including Wisconsin, to answer questions for people. And you can join in with your questions, your grammatical conflicts and confusions. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Al is with us in Green Bay. Al, hello.
Thanks for taking my call. So my question involves the word unique. I was brought up to believe that unique means one of a kind. Therefore, you would never put a modifier with it. You wouldn't say somewhat unique or kind of unique, because unique means one of a kind. It doesn't mean kind of one of a kind. But in later years, I've had other people try to tell me that unique simply means unusual. What's the ruling?
Al, thanks for the call. Ellen, how unique does something have to be before we can call it unique?
There's so many things that I could say about this, Al. I personally do not modify my unique. I use it as an absolute. So something is unique or not. I think the word is kind of spoiled because, you know, people who promote things like to make things very unique, extremely unique. And after a while, it just stops having the zing that it, you know, for me, it doesn't have much zing anymore. But it is it is used also by people to mean unusual, and it definitely takes on that meaning for me when they put an adverb in front of it. I just don't happen to do it myself. So, Al, I have your back. I follow your ways, and you know the world changes around us, right?
Thanks for that call. And you know, I always think of the United States Constitution. What are we going to create? A more perfect union. Right. And some people, I think, to this day say, well, perfect. You're either perfect or you're not. And how do you get more perfect? But so this kind of question has been around a long time.
I mean, I think I kind of sympathize with the there can be a more perfect or more unique thing. Yeah, because if you have a tiny blue marble and then you have a somewhat like a twice as big blue marble next to it, you can say that, OK, in a collection of small marbles, that bigger blue one is unique. But what if you then have a green one that's 100 times as big? The gap between them is bigger. And I think that is captured by the language, even though people don't like it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Lexi is with us in Elkhorn. Lexi, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. And I really love the title of the guest book. I just want to say that first. That's great. My question is about pleaded versus pled. Like, why do I hear on the radio he pleaded guilty? I think that's what I hear. And I want, like, my ear wants me to hear pled, like he pled guilty, but I don't hear people say that anymore. So I'm wondering what the difference is. And yeah, my ear just wants to hear that. It's a weird thing. Like, it hurts my ears when I hear pleaded guilty. And I also wanted to know how the guest became a grammar expert. That would be really interesting to me. And thank you.
Lexi, thanks for the call. Yeah, I think pled is right, but it's a really weird sound word, like pled. I don't know. Question, Ellen.
Yeah, so this is an example of the kind of thing that I bring out usage books for. You know, so when I set up the table, I always have this big pile of books, and I rely on Brian Garner's book, Garner's Modern English Usage for Things Like This, because he's a legal lexicographer. So may I just quote him briefly here for Lexi? Pleaded has always been the predominant past tense and past participial form. From the early 1600s, pleaded has appeared much more frequently in print sources than its rivals. Commentators on usage have long preferred it, pouring drops of vitriol onto has pled and has, oh, pled spelled E-A-D in that case. So my ear is used to pled, but you know, this is one of the words actually that I have a little bit of an experiential gap between me and the usage experts on. And there's a whole bunch more on that I won't read to you, but it's more complicated often than people
Interesting.
Think.
Interesting.
And then there was a second part. Oh, how
did you
time?
Become a grammar expert? Yeah, okay. Just give a quick origin story, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. I have taught writing and grammar my entire life. I majored in language and literature types of things. I have a degree in German and an MA in comparative literature. I have studied 25 languages, well, more than that on my own. And I'm sitting in front of a giant library of grammar books right now. So it's a lifelong obsession.
All right. Let's go back to our callers now. Thanks for that. Becky is with us in Rio. Becky, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the program. It's really interesting. So the word that hurts my ears is the plural of attorney general. I think it used to be attorney generals. Now I always hear attorneys general, and that just sounds awkward to me. Is that correct, or why has it changed?
Ooh, is it correct, and has it changed, Ellen?
I'm not aware of that having changed. I think I can't say for sure what the frequency is of the plural formations unless I go check a database for you. But I've always, my whole life, which has been a little bit, you know, it's longer than average for the planet now. I've always done attorneys general, and I suspect that you just hear both because people are doing both. That's how it often is with language, but I would do attorneys general.
Yeah. Because in this case, you think general, oh, that's like a military rank. So you're like the attorney general, but actually it's a general is a modifier of attorney. Like you do lots of different stuff. So it's attorneys
exactly.
general. Did I
exactly.
get that right? Excellent.
Yeah. And you say, and I also say mothers-in-law.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would too, for sure. Thanks. That's a great question at 800-642-1234. Let's go down to Bill in Milwaukee. Bill, hello.
Hello. I have a sentence for you. The Austrian crystal chandelier crashed to the floor below. Now, I was told that the names of countries are always adjectives, but in this one, it's an adverb. I've gotten in fights about this. What do you think?
Fights? Okay. Oh, okay. Oh, I get it. The distinction here is the chandelier Austrian, or is it a type of crystal called Austrian crystal?
Uh-huh. Bill, may I ask you, how did this even come up? Do you always parse sentences that you encounter?
I gave this to my students as a question on an exam. It was always fun to debate about it, but a guy in a bar really got mad. He said that the names of countries are always adjectives. I said that this one is describing an adjective, which makes it an adverb.
Austrian is an adverb. I gotcha. Bill, I don't know how much time you've spent in Ellen, but we spent all our time getting into fistfights in bars over grammar and language. Basically,
wow,
do you have a ruling for Bill on this one?
Well, I suspect, you know, it's funny because I grew up with, you know, sort of traditional grammar. I suspect linguists would probably not categorize, I would have to check with my linguist friends. I think they would probably not categorize it as adverbial strictly, but I see the point. I'm going to have to think about that.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot. Keep it calm out there, man. We're talking with grammar and language expert Ellen Jovan about her experiences operating a public grammar advice table around the country. She shares the story in her new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something that's always nagged at you about grammar, spelling, punctuation, pronunciation? Do you have a pet peeve or you need something resolved? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Ellen Jovan about her new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Let's go back to your many calls at 800-642-1234. We just heard about Austrian crystal. Now we'll go to Crystal Lake, Illinois with Carol. Carol, hi.
Hi, Rob. I can tell Ellen just loves her job just by that laugh. You can just tell. My query is about literally, and my beloved daughter uses it constantly, and I think, what does she mean? And then I'm seeing it written. A lot of people are using that now. What are they talking about?
Literally is literally everywhere, Ellen.
Don't start trouble here. Yeah, I mean, so when people say literally X happened and it didn't actually happen, it's a kind of hyperbolic statement. So I get it. Like I might say, oh my gosh, my head exploded when I heard that. And my head didn't actually explode. So I think that's kind of the idea behind the literally as non-literally supporting. That's that argument. I personally don't do that particular one. I exaggerate in many other ways.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Ellen, it seems like a lot of people have that pet peeve, that one or two or maybe 50 language things that bug them a lot.
It's true. And I actually think it serves various social functions that we probably can't quite grasp when we're busy arguing about them. I mean, so first of all, you often have peevers, like people who have peeves that they want to peeve about. And then you have peevers about peevers, who are the peevers who complain about the peevers. Well, no, they're not peevers. But they peeve about the peevers, which is a form of peeving. And it's kind of like this cycle. And it's sort of what I like about it is that even when people get annoyed, it doesn't usually come to fist fights. And I think there's a certain catharsis and a bonding thing in it, as long as it's not too mean. I don't like the mean spirited peeving. Mm.
And we can say peever and peeving and to peeve.
I made up two words already this afternoon. So
yeah, I do it all the time too.
Ask if you want strict rules about that.
Thanks again for the call. Mike is with us next in Eau Claire. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have, I guess, a pet peeve, too, when people say things like between you and I, and I know it should be between you and me. And I actually had a boss at work. I almost got into an argument with her, but I knew better, you know, than to try to argue with my boss about it. But I said, I said between you and me, and yeah, she corrected me. It's between you and I, Mike.
Uh-oh. So. Right. Mike, thanks a lot for that. It gets tricky, though, Ellen, because depending on where it is in a sense, like you and I are having a conversation, but this land was made for you and me. And then we, I don't know, it's easy to start second guessing you and
Rob,
me.
Rob, that was so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
May I respond?
Yeah, yeah.
Comment? Do I have time?
Definitely. Oh, we got lots of time.
Okay. So I actually was in an interview. I teach grammar courses to adults. So I was in an interview with a company where I was going to teach grammar courses for their employees. This was almost 20 years ago. And I said, you can feel free to call Brant or me. That's my partner or me. And then the person interviewing me asked about it because she thought it was wrong. And I explained it. And then I did not get that job. And the point of this is that there is grammar and then there's the politics of grammar.
Oh, well, I hope you got a better job after that with somebody more grammatically understanding. Thanks again for calling Ellen and me. We'll go next to Becky in Whitefish Bay. Becky, hello.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I love this program. I love this topic right now. I have taught English language learners for almost 20 years. And the thing that gets to me is when people say conversate instead of converse. I've always thought it was converse, and I think that people say conversate maybe as default because of conversation.
Huh.
But I, oh, that really irks me.
Becky, thanks. Ellen, I don't think I've encountered conversate all that often. Have you?
Oh, many, many times. It's really common. But, you know, I have talked to a lot of people.
True.
About these things. Yeah, I, you know, it's, there are often coexisting forms of verbs, and some of them are more common, or of words generally, not just of verbs, and that some are more common in certain dialects than in others. So I hear that among some demographics and less among others. And I, you know, I don't say it, but I've gotten used to it. And I think it's always when there's a clash in a word that we use a lot or hear a lot, there's always a little clash in our brain as we process it. So I just wish for peace for you.
Becky, thanks a lot for that call. I'm conversating with Ellen Jovan. Her new book is called Rebel with the Claws, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Katie is with us now in Eau Claire. Katie, hello.
Good afternoon. I have a question about the word memoir and when somebody has written a collection of their life stories, is it their memoirs or have they written a memoir?
Oh, they both sound vaguely right to me, Ellen. What's the deal?
You're the first person who's ever asked me about that.
Huh.
I wrote my memoir. I mean, I think my default is singular, but I would actually have to investigate the history of that one to be certain. I try to be very responsible in the information dispensed from the grammar table. So, by the way, Rob, I'm going to also be posting on my Twitter account about the Austrian crystal question, because I think traditional grammarians will say adverb and the not, and linguists will say something else. So I will also bring this one up there because this is fun for my grammar table language polls.
Excellent. All right. I will look for that later. Time for another call or two. Drew is with us in Grafton. Drew, hi. Are you there, Drew? Not hearing Drew. Let's try Victoria in Menominee. Victoria, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Victoria?
My biggest pet peeve is when people say axe instead of ask. I would just like to slap them.
Victoria, thanks for the call. Now, there are a lot of words where kind of, vowel or consonants will flip-flop, like, nuclear, axe instead of ask. What do you think about that one, Ellen?
Yeah, there's actually a long history for that kind of thing where you see that flipping. That's not an area of expertise for me. That's more a linguist domain. I believe John McWhorter, the linguist, has written about that, but it actually goes back a lot longer than people think, and has affected language in more ways, I suspect, than we realize. It's also part of African American vernacular, So you might hear it more there. So it's also, you know, within certain groups, you hear certain things more than others. I grew up near the Valley in the 80s in Los Angeles. So there are things that I am doing right now that are probably annoying people, and they may write to me about it afterwards.
Thanks for the call, Victoria. Todd is with us now, calling from north of Toma. Todd, hello.
Hi there. I was calling about the terms data and datum. And data, to me, is a plural term, so the data are compelling. But I hear it actually on NPR a fair amount, where people use data as a singular.
Todd, great question. You cover this in the book, Ellen. I try to write around it, so I never say data is or data are. I just change the damn sentence. What do you think?
I love this topic. I love all the grammar topics that intersect a little bit with mathy kinds of things. I love that extra. Somehow I haven't noticed that catching on as much with some other people, but I love it. Yes, it came into English as a plural, and datum came in as the singular. But here's reality for me. I cannot remember ever in my life hearing someone say datum, except maybe in some kind of scientific analysis. Data is used as a plural countable noun, but it is also used as a synonym for information generally. So the further you are away from a quantitative analysis with data points, the more likely you are to hear it as a singular. And I consider both acceptable.
Thanks for everybody's calls. And Ellen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I loved it.
Ellen Jovin is the author of the book Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. I talked to her back in August. You could still let us know if there's a grammar debate that you have with your friends and family, or just an interesting grammatical quirk that you find interesting. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin-based photographer Pete Souza shares some stories from his new book of photography based on his years as the White House photographer. Now the United States has aided Ukraine with billions of dollars in aid since Russia first invaded the European country this past February. According to polls, most Americans are in favor of Ukraine winning, and majorities support U.S. aid. But that support isn't universal. And Ukrainian leaders have expressed concern that the midterm elections in the U.S. could lead to a cut in support. Some Republican candidates and leaders, including House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, have criticized the scale of aid. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. should continue aiding Ukraine? Do you think the U.S. has already given enough? Will you vote in part based on attitudes toward Ukraine? What questions do you have about the latest there and the impact of the U.S. elections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Reuter is an associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
John, looking back, how important has U.S. aid, both military and economic, been for Ukraine and its ability to sustain its war effort to fend off this Russian invasion?
Oh, it's been crucial because the big disadvantage that the Ukrainians faced from the outset of the war was in materiel. The Russians had a lot more advanced weapons and a lot more of them. And so Western military aid was crucial for tipping that balance back in Ukraine's favor. And so, you know, in recent weeks, Ukraine has made a lot of progress on the battlefield, its first real major progress since March and April. They staged a successful counteroffensive in the Kharkiv region and retook a bunch of territory. And I think that would have been impossible without Western military aid.
What are you seeing when it comes to concerns from Ukrainian leaders and from Western European leaders when it comes to the future of U.S. aid for Ukraine?
Yeah, I think a lot of European leaders, well, and also, of course, Ukrainian leaders have been alarmed at some of the rumblings in the United States about wavering support for continued aid. And those signs have come from both ends of the political spectrum, funnily enough. So there was a letter from the Progressive Caucus, or some of the Progressive Caucus, House Democratic Caucus, that went out a few days ago and urged the Biden administration to try to enter in negotiations with Russia. Then also on the right, among Republicans, there's been some statements by Kevin McCarthy that maybe if the Republicans win in the midterms, that they might not be willing to use his phrase, not be willing to write a blank check for continued aid to Ukraine. And the concern, the big concern for Ukrainian leaders and European leaders is not just that the U.S. might start sending less aid, but that the U.S. is such a leader on this issue that if the U.S. starts to blink in its support for Ukraine and in sending aid to Ukraine, then that might be a signal to other European countries, and then they might follow suit, and that the coalition of support for aiding Ukraine might start to unravel.
Let's look at the Republican and Democratic statements you just mentioned in turn. Starting with Republicans, you mentioned the no blank check comment from Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. Now, we haven't had an election yet. We don't know what the outcome is going to be. One possibility is that Republicans control one or both houses of Congress, giving them the power to block funding potentially by threatening a government shutdown or by other means. But that's McCarthy. We've seen some Republican candidates criticize support from Ukraine. On the other hand, we're hearing from Senate current Minority Leader Mitch McConnell saying we're standing with Ukraine here. Former Vice President, likely presidential candidate Mike Pence saying Republicans should stick with Ukraine. What are you looking at when it comes to that debate within the Republican Party?
Yeah, that's right. And I think practically speaking, it's highly unlikely that funding levels for Ukraine are going to change, or the commitment to continuing military aid to Ukraine is going to change dramatically after the election for two main reasons. First, as you mentioned, there's still a large chunk of the Republican Party that is committed to standing up to Russia and aiding Ukraine. And second, and I think this is maybe less appreciated in the media these days, is that there's a lot of money that's already been approved that's still in the pipeline, that's still being distributed. So even in no new funds are approved in the fall or the spring, it's going to be quite a while before what's already been approved is spent down.
We're talking to John Reuter from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine and American politics and the impact that the midterm elections may or may not have on continued U.S. aid for Ukraine. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Okay, we've got that letter you mentioned. 30 House Democrats had signed on to this apparently three, four months ago. It expressed support from Ukraine and for the military support from the U.S. and then says, I'm going to quote here, "We urge you to pair the military and economic support the United States has provided to Ukraine with a proactive diplomatic push, redoubling efforts to seek a realistic framework for a ceasefire." Ending the quote there. It's a lot longer than that. And that seems to be the tricky bit. How much can the U.S. step in and enter direct negotiations without Ukraine taking the lead?
Yeah, I mean, the White House, their official position all along has been that it's not for the U.S. or any other European power to decide when to start negotiation, that's Ukraine's decision. But at the same time, I think it would be naive to think that the U.S., that their opinion on whether negotiations should start doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. They hold a lot of cards here. Right now, I think it's the opinion of the Biden administration that the most prudent thing to do is to try to give maximal support to Ukraine so that they can keep up this success on the battlefield. They've been relatively successful in the past few months, and so it doesn't make sense to start negotiations right now. And so, you know, I'm not privy to the internal details, but I think there was a lot of people who were angry in the Biden administration and also among other congressional Democrats about this letter, because it seemed to come at an inopportune time. And there was also concern that, you know, the Russians would be heartened by this, that they would be emboldened by this, that they would feel like their strategy of dragging the war out until the Western coalition in support of Ukraine started to crumble was vindicated.
And I should mention those members of Congress unsent that letter, I guess, or withdrew their support from the letter soon afterward. Now, I wanted to talk about that, what may be a strategy from Putin and the Russian leaders, that if they can hold on and wait things out, Western support will crumble. And we've seen things like we've got a new coalition government in Italy where the leader says, hey, we're still behind Ukraine. We're going to still contribute stuff. And then Silvio Berlusconi, former leader, prime minister of Italy, privately saying he blames Ukraine for the war, bragging about the vodka he got for his birthday from Putin. How do you think that this is really what Putin is hoping for, that we're going to see these elections change the level of support for Ukraine?
Well, yeah, I think it's not just these elections, but I think their general strategy is to try to hold their position on the battlefield until Western support starts to waver. So going back to your initial question, Rob, since that Western military support for Ukraine is so crucial, you know, that's the trump card that Ukraine has right now, is continuing to get this support. And so Russia has announced what they call partial mobilization. It's the draft, and they're calling up more servicemen and women. But that takes time to train up those new soldiers and get them ready for the battlefield. And so I think Putin's longer term strategy is to call up more soldiers and in the meantime, hope that Western support starts to waver.
We're talking to John Reuter, associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, about U.S. support and funding for Ukraine. What might be at stake during the midterm elections here in the U.S.? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does foreign policy matter for you? Does support for Ukraine matter to you when deciding who to vote for? Are you supporting political candidates that do or do not want to continue funding Ukraine? What do you want to see the U.S. policy look like dealing with the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with John Reuter, associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, joining us to talk about the war in Ukraine and how the midterm elections might affect how much money and military supplies the U.S. sends to Ukraine. By the way, you can learn more in the new Frontline documentary, Putin's Attack on Ukraine, documenting war crimes. The next airing is tonight at 11 p.m. There's more to come. Find more info at pbswisconsin.org. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the U.S. support of Ukraine? Do you want to see more of it? Do you think we've done enough? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. John, let's talk about the idea of negotiations. It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, Putin is very likely to want to keep some of the parts, at least, of Ukraine that he has taken over. And that seems like it would be a non-starter for Ukraine, which understandably wouldn't want to give up their territory. It seems like hard to find a starting point.
Yeah, I think that's right. But it's especially hard to find a starting point right now when the battlefield situation is in flux. I mean, so a few months ago, Russia was on the offensive and taking more territory, so they had no incentive to engage in negotiations. And now the shoe's on the other foot, and Ukraine is gaining territory, so they don't have an incentive. So we're not going to see, I don't think, negotiations here until there's a real battlefield stalemate, and both sides have exhausted their possibilities for finding new ways to prosecute the war
in a more escalatory fashion.
Now, the among the many difficulties here is this is a war being fought completely on Ukrainian soil. Ukraine is not going to invade Russia, I think. Nobody wants them to. Invading Russia, difficult under any circumstances. It seems like that might make it possible for Russia to sustain a war effort in the event of a stalemate for potentially a really long time.
Yeah, that's a really scary and depressing aspect of this war, is that... it's increasingly seems like it may be in Russia's interest to drag the war out, because as we were talking about earlier, what is really keeping Ukraine in the war is Western military support. And so if you think, you know, maybe 2 years down the road, the Russians are thinking maybe, well, maybe if Trump or a Republican wins those elections, then maybe really, you know, U.S. support for Ukraine will really decrease, and there'll be someone in the White House who is more open to the idea of dealing with Russia and entering into negotiations where Ukraine ends up, you know, making significant concessions.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Brookfield. John, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just think it's absolute foolishness not to continue to fund the Ukrainians. They're winning the war. Why would you walk away from the ability to degrade Russia's ability to bring war to the world, and especially with the horrendous way that they've conducted things? It's just ridiculous. And anybody that in Congress that votes to defund Ukraine, as far as I'm concerned, they're acting against the interests of the United States and the world peace.
John, thanks for that call. I've seen a couple things there, John Reuter, that this is in some ways an inexpensive investment from the United States to contain Russian aggression by stopping them at the Ukrainian border as much as possible. That stops whatever the next threat they might pose, say, to the Baltic states.
Yeah, I mean, that's the old, you know, strategy of containment or very similar to the old strategy of containment from the Cold War. But on the point about it being inexpensive, I mean, first I'll say I agree with the caller, but just so that we have something interesting to talk about here, on the point of it being inexpensive, the U.S. has actually contributed quite a lot to, in terms of aid to Ukraine. $27 sure. billion is the latest figure. It's not insignificant. And McCarthy's comment about how they weren't going to continue writing a blank check after the election if they won, that was actually in the context of a comment about how we might be going into recession. Mm-hmm. So, his point, I think, was, well, if we're going to be drawing down spending because we're going into a recession, we're, you know, this might be one of the things that's on the chopping block.
Sure. And John, thanks for that call. And also he brought up, John, the way that Russia is conducting the war. I mentioned that Frontline documentary, a concern about war crimes, targeting of civilians. What are we seeing there?
Yeah, I mean, it's. This is a very violent and bloody war, and there's going to be war crimes in any conflict like that, and this one's no exception. But I mean, I do think it's asymmetrical. I think Russia, there's ample evidence that Russia is committing a lot more war crimes in this conflict than Ukraine is. And I mean, if for no other reason than, like you said, this war is being carried out on Ukrainian territory, and there are civilians living there, and civilians get caught in the crossfire. Sometimes they're intentionally targeted for a variety of reasons, and yeah, so it's a very sad outcome.
Let's go back to our callers. Glenn is with us now in Northern Illinois. Glenn, hi.
Hi.
What is
it? Just a couple of comments. We certainly definitely need to keep financially supporting Ukraine as best we can. And I think also part of Putin's strategy deploying the 300,000 new troops is to hold on to and retain land that he
Glenn, I think I got your point. You're breaking up a little there. I don't know if you're able to make that out over the line, but Glenn saying Putin's strategy with this big draft, this big call up of troops is to hold the territory he's got and prolong the war by throwing more of these reservists and other people he's called up over the last couple of months.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely accurate. I mean, it seems paradoxical that Russia would be the party in this conflict that's having a manpower shortage, given the fact that Russia's population is three times larger than Ukraine's. But we have to remember that early in the war, Ukraine, they implemented general mobilization. So all able-bodied men over a certain age were called up and required to enlist. And Russia, early in the conflict, was trying to insulate its population from this conflict. They didn't want Russians to view this as a war. It was called a special military operation. They didn't want the Russian population to feel the impact of this war. So they were trying everything they could to actually to keep conscripts out of the war. Russia also has military conscription. Every male has to serve, but they only serve, you know, a year or two. And Russia was trying to not have its conscripts fight. They were trying to prosecute the war only using professional soldiers and contract soldiers and private military companies. But now Russia finds itself in the unfortunate for them situation where they're outnumbered in many instances on the back battlefield. And so they have to get more soldiers onto the battlefield if they're going to hold this territory. And that's what explains this partial mobilization.
Thanks for that call, Glenn. Jeff joins us now in Dousman. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, hi. I agree with John, early caller. And I also think it's important we stand up to Russian aggression. I feel that NATO kind of dropped the ball by allowing him to attack and not stopping it at the border.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. John, the idea of a NATO direct intervention in the war has been, it seems like, a non-starter here so far.
Yeah, it has been a non-starter. And the reason for that is quite simply that Russia is the world's largest nuclear power. They have more nuclear warheads even than the United States. And so the downside risk of some type of direct military confrontation with Russia that could escalate into an accidental or an intentional nuclear exchange is so great, even if it's an insignificant chance, that those consequences would be so grave that, you know, policymakers in Washington and Europe have been very careful to avoid any sort of direct confrontation with Russia. And I think that's the right thing to do.
Thanks for that call. On a related note, John, Russia has made claims that Ukraine would unleash not a nuclear weapon, but a dirty bomb, a conventional bomb with radioactive material attached to it. Ukraine saying this is Russian propaganda. Maybe they're setting up a false flag where they're going to do something like that. A lot of uncertainty here. How do you try to sort out these claims?
This is a very muddy situation to me as well. I can't understand fully what either the Ukrainians or the Russians would get militarily mm-hmm. out of using a dirty bomb. So these dirty bombs, they don't have much battlefield effectiveness, and they would only irradiate an area of maybe even a few hundred square meters. And so they're not particularly effective. So I think what this is, it's part of the information war going on where Russia is trying to delegitimize Ukraine and make the West. This is part of their campaign, I think, to unravel Western support, to make them realize how messy and potentially catastrophic this conflict could be. It's part of their effort to convince the West that of how messy things could get, and that it might be a good idea to wind this conflict down.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
That's John Reuter, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. He joined us for a look at the midterm elections and how they might affect U.S. aid to Ukraine. Again, check out PBS Wisconsin for one current and an upcoming frontline special on the war in Ukraine. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's a great time to cook some chili with cooler weather. You can make yours even better, get some great cooking advice, maybe even win a cook-off, or just impress your friends. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. There have been some big travel recommendations lately for Wisconsin's biggest city and one of our smallest communities. Starting in Milwaukee, National Geographic listed Milwaukee as one of their 25 travel destinations for 2023. That is a worldwide list. The list looks at tourism destinations that aren't the top travel sites but deserve more attention so you're not fighting crowds at the same old places. They list Milwaukee for the Great Lakes and riverfront opportunities, arts, culture, food, and music. They name drop Harley-Davidson Museum, Milwaukee Art Museum, the Bucks, the Beer, and more. On the opposite side of the state in the population list, Stockholm on the Mississippi River and Lake Pepin was listed as the number one coziest small town in the U.S. by the dating advisory site MyDatingAdvisor.com. They mentioned the shops, the restaurants, antique stores, art galleries, performing arts center, and a winery slash cidery. I personally experienced many of the places listed in both Milwaukee and Stockholm. So here in Wisconsin, from coast to coast, we boast the most. This is Central Time.